The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
The Steve Austin Show Unleashed is sponsored in part this week by True Car. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're gonna take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed. Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you right from the comfort of my couch. I am sitting here on my ass, and right here beside me, Callie and Moolah are sleeping their fool heads off. I just wore their asses out throwing a tennis ball for them with one of them, you know, those curved sticks that scoops up a tennis ball, lets you throw the tennis ball about four times further than you can normally throw it. God dang, I threw the shit out of that tennis ball and got their little asses tired. Callie came in here, was whining, pissing, and moaning, picking up a tennis ball and dropping it, picking it up and dropping it. I said, all right, you little son of a bitch, let's go out there and play tennis ball. So I wore her ass out. I got their exercise in for the day. Hey, I'm coming to you from the state of Nevada. Today is my last day here. It's been an extended stay. It's been awesome. Weather's been cold. It's been really mild as far as Nevada's concerned, but for my city slicker ass over there in the mean streets of Los Angeles and coming out of that heat in South Texas, it's been kind of chilly, but it's been nice. It's been beautiful country up here. Got a chance to ride my UTVs, ride my new four-wheeler. And, hey, you guys remember old Buck the Mule? I just sent a picture of Buck the Mule on my Instagram account with Callie and Moon. We was riding around the other day. Y'all know I named old Buck after Buck Owens, the famous country music singer. And so when I got my four-wheeler, I figured, well, every four-wheeler got to have a name, too. So I named my four-wheeler, my Kawasaki Brute Force, after the one and only legendary Chuck Norris. So I just call him Chuck. Chuck the four-wheeler. So I got Buck the Mule, and I got Chuck the Brute Force four-wheeler. That's his name. Me and Chuck fixing to go out there and do a little bit of biznatch here in a little bit. I'm going to get out there and nail that throttle back. I tell you what, you talk about an arm straightener. That is a badass four-wheeler. I'm enjoying the hell out of it. I tell you what, when I compare it to that old buggy, that black one that I used to ride on Monday Night Raw, it's a 2003 model. It's a 700. Ain't got no power steering. I remember when they first started coming out with these four-wheelers with power steering, I was like, man, power steering on a UTV makes sense. I get it because I've had both units, you know, without power steering and with power steering. On a four-wheeler, I was like, man, you got to be crazy. I'll tell you what, man, when you ride a four-wheeler with electronic power steering, it is like a whole different experience. So, badass four-wheeler. His name is Chuck. From now on, when you hear me talk about Chuck, I'm talking about my damn four-wheeler. You already know Buck the Mule. I'll tell you what, we're going to get up early tomorrow morning. Thursdays, you download this podcast. I'm recording this on Wednesday. We're going to get up about 6 a.m. in the morning, leave out of here. It's been great spending time with my brother-in-law, Mitch. Well, my brother. Hanging out with him and getting a chance to ride with him out here and see some of this BLM. It's been awesome. Heading back to Los Angeles. And, you know, we got a chance to finally get out of that big-ass city. Normally, we're down there at the Broken Skull Ranch. And I just had to get out of all that chaos, that smoke, smog, and ambulances, helicopters, sirens, all that shit that you hear all the time. So it's been peaceful. It's been quiet. And tomorrow I make my return back to 316 Gimmick Street and get back in the thick of things. So it's going to be an interesting transition to go from the peace and quiet being out here in the middle of nowhere back to the mean streets of Los Angeles. And don't get me wrong, I ain't running down Los Angeles. I think it's a great town. It's a good city. It's the entertainment capital of the United States. All that shit, it facilitates a lot of business for me, and it's been a good place for me to be. Met my wife. It is what it is, but it's been nice to get out of it. Tomorrow I get back in amongst it, and I will be hauling ass and trying to keep pace with everybody. And it will be interesting to digest all the noises and all the the people walking the streets, people not looking both ways when a pedestrian light comes on, everybody using the damn cell phones and sending text messages while they're driving, all that stuff that just chaps my ass. Yeah, tomorrow I get back in the middle of it. Got some cool people lying to come up to 317 Gimmick Street. While I'm talking about the next podcast, over the weekend, I'm going to shoot the breeze once again with Brutus the Barber Beefcake. He's got a book out right now that is BrutusBeefcake.com. It's his life story. I got a lot of response on that podcast with Brutus, and I had a damn good time talking to him, a guy who I've never really talked to before. And we're going to switch it up. We're going to talk a little bit about his run down there in WCW. We're going to talk about his days wrestling over in Japan, the overseas experience for him. And due to the response, I called him up. I said, hey, Brutus. Well, I call him Ed. I said, hey, Ed, man, I've got a lot of good feedback off that podcast. I said, what if we open it up to the fans and we do a question and answer, do Q&As, so that way they supply the questions and you supply the answer. And Ed Brutus said, hey, man, that sounds like an awesome idea. Let's do it. So anyway, I'm asking you, the people who listen to the podcast, if you've got questions for Brutus the Barber Beefcake, what it pertains to is WWF run, WCW run, Japan, anything in general you want to ask the guy, send your questions now, and please put subject matter, Brutus Beefcake. Send those questions to questions@steveaustinshow.com. I'm going to start compiling those, putting them on a list, and I'm going to talk to Ed, I believe, on Saturday or Sunday for a future podcast. So I'm talking to Brutus the Barber Beefcake. We're taking questions that you sent in, along with some of my own, as he rejoins me on another session of Shooting the Breeze and talking about the business of pro wrestling. And speaking of the business of pro wrestling, that brings me up to my next guest. And today is part two of my conversation with the one and only Al Snow. It's always a pleasure to talk to Al, just like I said last time. I don't know if you guys got a chance to check out that match of him and Hannibal working that match and watch some of the cues and things I told you to watch. He's got a website. It's called collarandelbowbrand.com. He's selling some T-shirts and merchandise, wrestling-related stuff. Al is a guy who's got 36 years seniority, as Sheriff Buford T. Justice would say, in the business of professional wrestling. Guy has paid his dues and then some and is still around. Great mind for the business. We're shooting the breeze again and catching up. But check out his website, collarandelbowbrand.com. They got some cool-ass shirts, so check it out. But dig it. I got Brutus the Barber Beefcake coming up in a future podcast. Send me your questions now, please, or in the next few days to questions@steveaustinshow.com. Enjoy my conversation with Al. I always enjoy talking to him. Real knowledgeable guy. We're going to drop a story about how he helped me out in 1995 before I got into the WWF. And his contributions to my match at WrestleMania 13 with the legendary one and only Hitman, Bret Hart. But before we get to my guest, Al Snow, let's take a quick pause for the calls and give big ups to a sponsor who makes this podcast possible, and I appreciate that, and that is TrueCar. Here are some useful car tips you might not be aware of. A coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. And removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. And finally, placing your key fob to your chin will increase its range. Weird, right? Well, are you ready for one more tip that you might not know about? TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar ain't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what others paid, so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Don't get taken to the cleaners. Check out TrueCar. Some features not available in all states.
Coming soon to Podcast One, Red Circle Sports with Dennis Miller. Get your weekend sports roundup every Tuesday exclusively from Podcast One and comedian Dennis Miller. He's going through and circling the most exciting headlines so you don't have to, and bringing you a lot of laughs along with them. Be sure to download new episodes of Red Circle Sports with Dennis Miller every Tuesday on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or at PodcastOne.com.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
All right, I'm sitting here, part two with Al Snow, sitting there shooting the breeze. Hey, man, I want to talk, as I alluded to in the first episode, when I came to WWF in 1995 as a ringmaster, before I made my debut, I was very rusty. Now, I'd had about two or three matches, one with Mikey Whipwreck and one with Mikey and Sandman, but, you know, they were pretty short. They were what they were, and I knew I needed to knock the rust off to some degree. And I told Vince I'd like to go to Al Snow's wrestling school up there in Lima, Ohio before I start so I can knock a little bit more rust off because I hadn't really been active. And he goes, that'd be fine. So they flew me up. Here's the thing. On the last episode, I told you my memory is not so great. So I'm asking you, the question is, where did we first meet? I know, you know, you and I are friends, but it's not like we hung around together all the time. But I had a lot of respect for you and appreciated you. You're a great teacher. You have a great way to break things down and explain things. I didn't need to be taught a whole lot of stuff. I needed to get the ring rust knocked off. So tell the story, dude. How did it come about that we met and then I ended up at your place for 5 days?
Well, you know, my memory's not that good either. I just know when we first met, we hit it right off. And I, you know, I appreciate you, you know, telling me, you know, I thank you so much. That's awfully nice. That means a lot to me. But we just hit it off. And, you know, and I remember you coming and asking me, you know, if it'd be all right if you came to the school. And I was like, yeah, of course. You know, I would be happy to have you come there. And I mean, you came and we hung out for those 5 days and worked on stuff in the ring, and it was awesome. You kept farting on me whenever I would try and show you different roll-ups and stuff.
I remember that.
You'd fart on me, and I'm like, God damn, man. You're killing me. All right, and then you wanted to learn some submissions and different submissions, and I was trying to show you different submissions, and I'd push on you, and then I must have been pushing right on you enough to where you'd bust ass. Oh, Jesus.
I think, Al, at that stage of my career, I was living purely on beans and alcohol.
Yeah.
But
there were some strong ones too, man.
I do remember I told Vince, I said, man, I gotta knock some of the ring rust off. I want to go see Al Snow. And so they flew me up there for 5 days. And then, you know, I make my debut, my unceremonious debut as a ringmaster. And that lasted for 6 months. And then, I remember before I had that submission match with Bret the Hitman Hart, I came to you again. And I said, "Hey, man," I said, "I got a submission match, and dude, you know my style. It changed a little bit from USWA, WCW to WWF after I got dumped on my head. But I was never a scientific wonder. I was a mechanic, but I didn't know any submission moves. So we talked, and you gave me a couple, and I think that one that I ended up using, I don't even know what it was called." So anyway, you were a very big part of WrestleMania 13, and although nobody knows that.
Well, thank you. You know, I always enjoyed working with you, and, you know, I think the submissions came from when I, you know, worked with Dan and had trained him for his first UFC, you know, UFC 4 out in Tulsa, which ultimately that was the thing that got me booked in Smoky Mountain too, and that's why I tell guys all the time it's so important to have a personality, a character, you know, a demonstrative personality. It's not just about your physical ability, because I mean, back then I was doing springboard stuff. I tell guys all the time in Smoky Mountain, you know, and in Smoky Mountain the ropes were high. They came up above up to your chest. I could stand on the ring apron in the center of the ring, of the ring apron, spring up, turn in midair, land on the top rope, moonsault in, land on my feet, laying on my belly, whatever you wanted me to do. You know, I had no issue. And that never got me booked until Jimmy saw me on that pay-per-view with Dan at the UFC after Dan won his second fight. And I made some smart-ass comment to the interviewer because he was trying to get Dan to put Hoist Gracie over. And Dan was just kind of, And I just made some smart-ass comment. And then, you know, Jimmy saw that, and it showed I had a personality that he could use, and that's how I got booked, you know, in Smoky Mountain, which ultimately led me to WWF, and then except so on, you know, and getting a chance to work with you and become friends with you and everything. If it hadn't been for going to that pay-per-view with Dan, you know, who knows where my career would have went.
Let's go back to the early days, 1982. I guess that's when you made your debut. But growing up as a kid, did you grow up in Lima?
Yeah, I grew up in Lima, and we had like in the Sheik's territory, which, you know, back in the day, like Ohio and Michigan was always the money territory. You know, that was the territory everybody always wanted because you could run Detroit, which was a major town. There was Grand Rapids was a major town. Saginaw was a major town. You know, Benton Harbor, where Bobo Brazil was, near on the northwest side of Michigan, was a major town. You could go down to Kellogg. You could go down to Battle Creek. You could go down to Kellogg. Then when you came down to Ohio, Ohio was the best territory because you went to Toledo. That was a major city. So you drew a good, you could draw, make money. And then literally 2 hours from Toledo was Dayton. And then literally from Dayton to Cincinnati was an hour. From Cincinnati to Columbus was an hour and a half. From Columbus to Cleveland was an hour and a half. From Cleveland to Akron was an hour and a half. And you could just sit there and do that loop, you know, and you could draw, you know, they'd run Hare Arena in Dayton, which was seats like 6,000 people. You'd run Cincinnati at the Cincinnati Gardens, and, you know, and the Sheik would run the gardens, and it seats 7 to 10, you know, and you could do that. I mean, and it was an easy, you were home every night, and, you know, it's a couple hour ride. You know, it wasn't like when you worked in Louisiana or worked some of these other territories where you had to go out for a 300-400 mile ride, you know, just get to the next town.
Well, dude, if I'm doing the math, you broke in 82, you're 54. So how old were you when you broke in? 18, 19?
18.
Yeah.
18.
Okay. So at 18, you know, when did you start watching the business?
Started watching it when I was like, you know, really young, like 4 or 5 with the Sheik's territory. And then, and Sheik burned the territory to the ground. We had no wrestling whatsoever in the area around mid-70s, I think.
But when you say the Sheik burned the territory to the ground, was he pushing himself too much at that point?
No, he was not paying people.
Oh, you know, copy.
Not paying bills and not, you know, and shorting people and doing the old, you know, the son, George, come running in, Dad, somebody stole the box office, you know, that kind of thing.
Hey, man, you know, tell me about the Sheik. How was he?
Sheik, honest to God, I mean, you know, he was awesome because if you think about it, okay, this is a testament to how good a worker he was. He was only maybe in a business back then where most of the guys were, you know, they're big guys.
Yeah.
So the Sheik, you know, he's maybe, I think, 5'10", and, you know, a little over 200 pounds, maybe 220, 230, right? But, you know, after I got smartened up and broke in the business, was in the business for a couple of years, Sheik would be on a show. Like, I remember being walking in the locker room in Cleveland. I was terrified. I was still terrified because of that persona that he could project. Because the thing is, like, he believed. You know what I mean? So you believed. And if he came in the audience, brother, you scattered. You know what I mean? And when he came walking in the locker room, I was like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Oh, damn, he's here. You know, because you're just scared to death of him. He carried that kind of aura around it. And you know why? You remember, you know, because Sabu does it too.
Yeah.
And nobody, you know, the point, you know where he got that?
Where?
He got it from the old Fay Wray King Kong movie to make him look bigger. Like he was reaching to the sky, make him look like he was larger than what he was.
Oh, hey, what'd you learn from that guy? Just as far as, I always love your explanation of heat. Dude, I've watched all your shit on YouTube. So what did you take away from your dealings with the Sheik? Because, I mean, there's a guy who wasn't the biggest guy. He owned a territory. But God dang, you know, me growing up in South Texas, I didn't get all that, you know, because it was so much more regional back then. But I just heard all these stories about the Sheik, you know, Dick the Bruiser. Yeah. But the Sheik was the man. In that territory, what was it about him? Yeah, he believed, he was vicious, he was violent. But what did you take away from him as far as a tool that you would employ later on in your career or something you would take away as far as teaching other people?
He believed so much in him and what he did and his gimmick. There was no way you didn't believe in it. And he never broke character. Like he never spoke. He never did an interview. And in public, never heard him talk. And that's important because that's what he sold to the audience. And that was what they bought. And he never gave them something other than what they paid for. He always gave them the Sheik. If he was out in public and somebody wrecked, he was the Sheik. He became the Sheik. If they didn't recognize him, he was just Ed Farhat, and he'd try to keep a low profile, you know what I mean? But if they were like, hey, are you the Sheik? And if he, you know, right into gimmick. It didn't matter where he was, didn't matter what he was doing. And I did that when I was really getting over with the head. And it was uncomfortable, I got to be honest. But, like, after I get done working, I'd go to dinner by myself, and I'd set the head on the table, and I'd buy dinner for the head, and we'd sit there and have a conversation, you know, while people were sitting here in the restaurant looking at us like, what the hell are you doing? You know what I mean? People come up and, hey, the waiter come up and, you know, you're making the other people nervous. I'll be like, well, they're making us nervous, okay? So, and it's hard. You know, it's hard to do that, to commit like that. But, you know, like I tell the young guys, like, if somebody's flipping through the channels, through the TV, and they see me, and they remember seeing me at the restaurant, and they go, hey, there's that guy. Remember him? This guy's completely nuts. So now if they believed in me, they could believe in anything I did, you know? No matter what, how ridiculous or how, which, let's face it, they made me do a lot of ridiculous shit. I mean, they made me do a lot of stupid things. But I could do it and get away with it because people thought I was legitimately insane. Like I was completely out of my mind.
I love it. And I was watching some of your travel stories with the head. They're on the videos that I'm going to reference in the open of the show and the ones that I watched. But I want to get your thoughts while we're talking about committing to character of a guy who I thought was kind of ahead of his time and a guy who had a lot of balls and doing what he did. Brian Pillman.
Yeah.
What did you think when he kind of created the, what was that, the loose cannon? Yeah. Everybody called him the loose cannon.
Brian was awesome. I mean, Brian was solid from top to bottom, but he just kind of meandered in the middle. They never really, you know, and that the reason why was because you couldn't turn and go, hey, there's this guy, Brian Pillman, and he's A, B, C, D, E. I mean, he did the same thing we all do. He just kind of floated. He was not bad. He was good. He was a good hand. But he just did not have that discernible character until he started doing that loose cannon thing where it was like, shit, this guy, you could tell he don't care. Like, you have no idea whatever you don't know what he's going to do. You don't know where he's going to go. You don't know what he's going to say, you know, and you got to watch him because you don't know what he's going to do. I mean, it was fascinating.
I've always told the story a bunch of times. We were down in Dothan, Alabama doing a television tape for WCW. I was about to do a U.S. championship run with Harley Race as my manager. Brian comes up to me and says, kid, we got to come up with a finish move. We're a tag team now. Anyway, people have heard me tell that story before. So anyway, all of a sudden we turn into a tag team. Mismatched trunks, all this stuff. We get matching trunks, matching vests, gold chains, Hollywood blondes. It's all Brian's idea. Yeah. So anyway, you know, I end up getting hurt. I get fired. I go to ECW, end up in WWF. And so I'm watching Brian. He's doing all this stuff. And I don't know who you were traveling with, but back in the day, it was myself and Brian Pillman and Raven, Scott Levy. And we were always together renting a Chevy aluminum vans. And, you know, back in the day, you know, you'd be around the boys so much. When you get home, it's like you just want to be home. Now, all of a sudden, when you get home, here's the sickness. When you get home, as much as you wanted to get home after a day and a half, you're ready to get the F back on the road.
Yeah, that's right.
But the last thing you want to do is hear from one of the boys because you just got finished hanging out with them for 3 weeks on the road. And sure enough, as soon as I got home, the sun would go down, that my phone would ring. This is the old school phone stuck on side of the wall with a long cord. If you had a long cord, the gimmick cord, so you could cook while you talked on the phone.
Or you could get a little bit of privacy by going around the wall.
Yeah.
Trying to talk. Nobody
all of a sudden, I'd pick up the phone. Hello? Kid, I got a scoop for you. It was Brian Pillman because, you know, he'd read all the dirt sheets back before, you know, all the boys were reading the dirt sheets, right? Because you never want to get caught with a dirt sheet in your hand. But anyway, back to the story. Man, when he came up with that loose cannon gimmick, it was so out there and he was so committed to it. It was like in one of your interviews that I was watching, he was like, you're talking about David Copperfield, I believe, or no, you're talking about, what's the other guy? Chris Angel. You're talking about Chris Angel. Everybody knows what he's doing isn't, you know, it's an illusion.
Yeah.
But you always don't want to ask because you don't want to know. And the thing with Brian, when he started doing all the stuff, we were still very good friends. I didn't want to ask him. Because I was just watching, but I was watching, as was, you know, the whole wrestling world and all of the boys. They're like, we're like, man, what the fuck, dude? Because I never asked him because I didn't want to know and I didn't want him to try to break character because I was truly fascinated by what he was doing. And
to work himself out of a contract, to get into a contract, and to create an opportunity for himself. I just thought it was crazy, and I'll never forget when we had that pay-per-view, and we'd worked many the night before, and I seen him kind of zigzagging through the back of the dressing room. Yeah. He would die, I guess, that night or sometime around that time frame. And it really just shook me up on that Monday Night Raw when they told that bell. But God dang, dude, just what he did was incredible. What did you think about what he did? I'm sorry to get distracted and get into all that specific. The guy was such a good friend to me. But what were your thoughts about how far he pushed that envelope? Because I love the shit out of it.
I thought it was awesome because, again, like we talked about, like he was there and he was on the radar. And if he had never, a testament to the success of it is that you and I still talk about it today. You know what I mean? And that's a testament to if you want to really, like we all debate about how over somebody got and who did this and who did that. You really want to judge it. You still talk about it to this day. Fans still know who Brian Pillman is. You know, a new generation of fans know who Brian Pillman is and was. And the reason they do is because he took that chance. He took that opportunity when he got out there. And I guarantee it's not like something that anybody told him to do. He knew he had to, you know, take the bull by the horns and he had to do something, and he had to do it in a big way. To, you know, otherwise he was going to be screwed. You know what I mean? He was going to sit there and fade away, and he did it. I mean that, and to the point where we still talk about it now. And I mean, when he was doing it, I was like you. I was shocked. I was like, man, he's going a little too far. You know what I mean? Because the last thing any of us want to ever do is turn the channel heat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like but people got like caught up in it because you could believe in it. It wasn't like it came across fake or anything. I think it was, and I'm just speculating because I don't really know, but I'm sure Brian was probably really frustrated. I think he was, you know, because he knew that he was more capable than what he was being utilized or where he was on the card. And really that comes down to the fact that, again, that Brian just didn't have that discernible character that you could turn and go, okay, there's this guy and I can tell this story with that will draw this kind of business for us. You know what I mean? He got so frustrated that when he cut loose, all of that came out, and that, you know, people could feel it. They could tell it was real, and that's why they believed in it, you know.
And before we move on, you know, and I think it was in WCW in the early 90s, he had a match. It was really only a 10 or 11 minute match with Jushin Thunder Liger. It was a match of the year, according to Dave Meltzer. I don't want to get you wound up here.
I don't have any heat with
him. Okay.
I just have heat with people who listen to him and do what he thinks is the right thing. That's
okay. So he has a match of the year. We're the Hollywood Blondes. He's Brian Pillman, but he's remembered for that persona. Yeah. And that goes back to one of your discernible character traits or this persona, which you must have. As you came up in the business or in the indie scene, first tell me about Jim Lancaster. Who was he?
But Jim Lancaster was a guy, he had started under Louis Klein and in the Sheik's territory. And then he left from the Sheik, he went down into Crockett's, and he made the loops into a bunch of the different territories. But he spent a lot of time in the Midwest working for Vern, and he was a big guy. He was about 6'3", 6'4", but he was like 365, 385. And I'm not putting him over just because he was the guy that broke me into the business. Because initially, he didn't want nothing to do with me. You know, and that's, we talk, you know, I talk about the degradation of the business, and I think a lot of it comes down to that, is that, you know, personal responsibility that somebody takes on when they break you in the business. You know, back in the day, I tell guys all the time, and they're like, yeah, it's not, you know, but it was easier to become a made man in the mafia than it was to get in the wrestling business. Because if I train you, you know, and I would use this on Tough Enough, and I'd refer to them as my kids, and everybody's like, oh, you're such a great father figure. I'm like, I didn't take these kids to raise. They ain't my kids. What I meant by, I'm Jim Lancaster's kid. You know what I mean? Whoever broke, you know, the boys that broke you in the business, you're their kid. That means they're responsible for you. That means that if you do something to this day, if I say something on this podcast, and one of the older guys hears it, and they call Jim up, hey, your kid, you know, I heard him on Steve Austin's podcast, and he blah, 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 blah. I'll get a phone call. and they'll be like, hey, what's going on? I heard you did Steve Austin's podcast. I'll be like, yeah, and I have to explain it to him, you know, and so I don't have any heat. And that was the way it was back then. But Jim was like, he was like a mid-card guy. I know he worked with the Bounty Hunters as a manager at one point down in USWA down in Tennessee, Memphis, with Lawler and Jarrett. He had just had his daughter, and he was trying to kind of back away from being on the road all the time. And he wanted to settle down, and he was trying to start running his own shows. And Dick the Bruiser, he was getting talent from Dick's office, and was using Dick's son-in-law, Spike, humor. And one night, Jim had a show, and he had Spike on the card, and Dick sent Spike to St. Louis and, you know, didn't notify Jim or anything. So Spike no-showed the card. So Jim called Dick, and Dick's like, yeah, he had a better payoff in, you know, St. Louis. I didn't send the kid over there. You know, you understand. So when I first met Jim, he didn't want to train anybody, didn't want any part in it, didn't want to get involved or anything like that. But then when that happened, he figured, well, you know what? I'm going to get my own group of guys. I know I'm going to be able to rely on them. They'll be loyal to me. And then I can have them on these shows and, you know, I can be guaranteed that I got certain talent. So that was how, after I went down to the Andersons and they beat the shit out of me and broke my nose, I took the 24-hour bus ride back home. And then, you know, he had told me, he said, before I went, he said, you know, call me and let me know how it goes. I go, you know, he knew I was going to basically get the hell beat out of me. So I called him up, you know, and he's like, well, I've a couple other guys that contacted me and want me to train them. He says, I'll train you. And I'm like, perfect, you know. So then we didn't have wrestling schools really per se back then, you know, like Vern trained in a barn on his farm, and, you know, other guys trained other places. So, you know, now I got to go find some place to get trained. So I call up the high school where I just graduated, and I'm like, hey, I talked to the wrestling coach. I'm like, yeah, when you get trained to be a professional wrestler, you think you could let us use the wrestling mats after you guys get done after practice? Yeah, sure. So first day, I can't wait. You know, it's like December or something, and I'm can't wait to get there. I show up at the school, none of the lights are on. You know, I'm like, it's in the gym, so you can't see the gym, ain't got no windows. Walk around the building, I find a door open, walk in the door, walk up and down the hallway. Next thing I know, the two cops show up with their guns drawn, screaming at me to get on the floor. The school had been shut down that day because there had been a snowstorm, and I didn't know because I graduated back in July or back in June of the year before. So, you know, I had no idea. So, of course, I lose the school. So now I got to go to this community center. I got to lie to the guy that runs the community center and tell him, yeah, if you let us use this little room back here, you know, they had two tumbling mats on the cement floor, and they had a boxing ring. He said, you let us use the facilities to train, I'll train all the neighborhood kids how to wrestle. And then he's like, oh, okay, that'd be great. Never trained one kid in my life. You know, never trained any of the kids. Walk in there, you know, get trained on a 2 half-inch tumbling mats, and then we'd go up in the, do some ring work up in the boxing ring, which was ridiculous.
So tell me about wrestling school with Jim Lancaster. You got two regular mats, you got a little boxing ring. Yeah. So I don't imagine you're doing a whole lot of high spots. Are you doing any tumble drills? Is it just purely mat work? Because what I'm getting to is you're learning from, it sounds like a meat and potatoes guy, sound worker, and all of a sudden you would end up doing, you know, the style you were alluding to in the first episode, off the top rope, this, that, and whatever. So tell me about that and how you would segue into the type of worker you became. But always being able to go back to that match against Hannibal to basic ground and, you know, solid storyline.
Jim was a meat and potato kind of guy, but he was an awesome heel. Because he could do even and I try to explain this to people, but you'll understand, like, he could do the slightest thing and he'd get so much out of it. You know what I mean? Because he moved very slow, very methodically, and he knew just what to do at the right time to get heat, to get people to really, because he knew how to get a baby face over. And he was the big, you know, he was the big aggressive heel. So, you know, he never came right out because he was so big. He knew that if he came right out and he just mauled a guy, it would kill his size. Because now if the guy's going over on him, that screwed it. But two, if he mauled the guy too much too soon, it killed his size because you should have just been able to beat the guy. And I'd learn little subtle things. Like I'd watch him. If he got a guy down, like in a rear chin lock, or he'd even if he got to go do a cover, he'd always make sure the baby face got out before he ever got all of his weight on it. Because he never wanted to put all of his weight on the guy because the guy couldn't get up. It wasn't believable. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it was just little things I'd watch him do. You know, and this was back in the day when they'd use the gimmick, like the
tongue thrust. But it protected himself.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't kill his gimmick.
Wouldn't kill his size.
Gotcha.
So that when he would hit somebody with like a splash or something, they'd think the guy was dead because they never could see the guy counter Jim's weight. You know, and a lot, you know, and a lot of it was, you know, he knew the gimmick of the match. And that's what I tell guys all the time. You always work the objective. You always sell the objective to work the gimmick of the match, to tell your story, to do your business. So the objective is you always try to win. The gimmick is, okay, how do I win? So for Jim, the idea was his gimmick was his size. How are you going to get this big guy off his feet so you can pin him? So now where's all the heat come from? 9 times out of 10, it comes out of trying to see the babyface finally knock him off his feet. So he'd spend the whole match just, whether it was 2 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, you'd watch that babyface slowly chipping away, trying to almost, and he'd never bury his weight, he'd never bury his size, and then the babyface would finally catch him, and it would either cause him to bump, which would make him screw the babyface by pulling the tights or, you know, hitting him with a gimmick, the tongue depressor or something to catch the win, or the babyface would bump, which would lead to the babyface catching the win on him, you know. And the crowd would react accordingly because they believed in the whole thing. But he meticulously do it throughout the match. I remember one night the audience was sitting there and they weren't making a noise sound. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking, well, you know, this crowd's dead. You know, like we all think, well, this crowd's dead. And it must have been maybe 8-10 minutes of dead silence. And then all of a sudden, this baby face starts blowing his comeback, and the place comes, literally unglued, and hits, you know, Jim with like a drop kick or something. It was something simple. Flying cross body or something. And Jim finally takes that big bump, and the place just exploded. I mean, it just went insane. And when he came back, I said, well, you didn't have him for 10 minutes. He goes, no, I had him the most for those 10 minutes. I said, what do you mean? He goes, they didn't make a sound because they were waiting for the next thing to happen. And he had him right in the palm of his hand the whole time. And he just sat and just built the heat to the point when they, you know, making that audience beg and want to see that babyface make that comeback by doing literally nothing. I mean, he just kept the rear chin line and just kept grinding the guy, but always keeping his weight up off the guy. You know, never quite. And then watching the guy slowly try to work his way back to his feet, the crowd just sitting there, entranced, not making a sound. So I learned a lot of that kind of psychology from him. You know, I think he was a really underrated guy when it came to that kind of thing.
Well, how long did you train with him before you actually had your first professional wrestling match? And how were you? Because I'm imagining you were amazing.
I was amazingly terrible.
My brother, I was too.
There's like one of my first promo pictures that I had the Tarzan top because that was – well, you used to – remember bought everything at K&H, Colin Hildegard, right? So – and K&H was in Johnstown, Ohio. It was just outside of Columbus. So and back in the day, you know, remember we didn't have – you know, you didn't have Amazon. You didn't have – you know, it was UPS. And it was cash on – COD, cash on delivery.
Yep.
So a lot of that stuff, the boys would order – and then, of course, they wouldn't pay for it, and it would get returned back to K&H, right, to call Hilliard. So Jim would load us all up in the car. We'd take a ride down there, and we'd go scurrying through all the old return stuff. So, you know, I find a Tarzan top, and I got the basically like an afro hairstyle. I got that 14-year-old mustache on my 18-year-old face. And
what was the gimmick?
There was no gimmick. It was flatter than piss on a plate.
How'd that match go?
It didn't go good. So I trained with Jim for I think 4 months, where there were no tumbles, there were no rolls. You were taught first how to walk. That was the first thing you were taught, because you had to learn how to walk like a fighter would walk. Because guys don't understand how important that is. Like, you never watch a boxer cross his feet. You never watch an MMA guy cross his feet. So as a professional wrestler, that's the last thing you should ever do, too, is cross your feet. So the first thing was taught, how to walk. Now, let's learn to lock up. Why do we learn to lock up? Well, it's the safest way for me to teach you, for him to teach me to move with another guy and make it look real without actually potatoing the guy. You know what I mean? Stiffing him and hurting him. So now we're going to learn control by moving each other around. Now we learn how to take a headlock because that's the most basic hold. You learn how to work the hold, where your feet go, what you need, how you need to stand. Now you learn how to take him over. So you learn how to do all this through you learning to work together to make it look believable and to sell it, but you're incrementally, you start adding more holds, more moves, things like that, you know. Never was taught to punch, taught to throw a forearm, and the right way to throw a forearm so that way you would learn from the mechanics of how to throw a forearm, you'd learn how to throw a punch the right way. You know, where you can make it look tight, make it look crisp, make it look good, but never actually stiff the guy. You know, never hit hard in an unsafe place. So, and then we never got smartened up. I mean, we went for probably three and a half months where, you know, we were learning to work and it was like, you know, you just go half speed. You work with me. He'd get in there physically and so he could see how tight you were and how well you moved, but he'd never smarten you up. And, we weren't smartened up until one time, you know, he needed us on a show and he came to me and he's like, you know, if I put you in there in the ring, can you go out there and not try to win? Just go like half speed with you. And I'm like, no. No, if I'm going to go out there, I'm going to try and beat his ass. I'm going to win. Because I was completely, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, I'm in it to win it. I'm not going out there just to roll around. And he was like, look, I got to smarten this guy up, you know, because he's a lunatic. He's an idiot. He doesn't get it. I still didn't get it. I was like, this is a shoot. This is what I'm doing. I'm going out to win. I'm going to beat this guy. He's like, okay, here you go. Here's what we do. Here's why we do it. And you're to never say anything to anyone. And I was like, I get it. He goes, if I ever find out you did, you're going to regret it. I'm like, I won't say a word. I promise. I swear I won't. I never even smartened my own mother up for years. So, Louis Calais and the Fullers, they took over Memphis TV. It went up into Ohio. And so they wanted to cheek. At that point, the territory was dead. Everybody wanted, even Anderson, Ole Anderson eventually started taking WCW up into Ohio too. And, I used to work for the Murnicks when they were the road agents for the Crockett's. When they would come up in Ohio, I would always work the opening matches and stuff, whenever they'd work through Ohio, Michigan, or Eastern, or Western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. I'd work for the Murnicks. So my first show was in Springfield, Ohio on May 22nd of 1982. And it was a 20-man, two-ring battle royal. And there were guys, you know, I walk in the dressing room and there's guys like Austin Idol, who, brother, I mean, like, he was so over with
yeah.
me, you know what I mean? I mean, he had the body, he could cut the promo, you know, he was awesome. And, Randy Rose, Norgo Austin, Rick McCord was there, Al Perez was there. A lot of guys, you know, so we had this 20-man battle royal. And so I'm, you know, hey kid, no offense, but you know, when we get you in the second ring, you'll be the first one out. I'm like, oh, okay. So, you know, I think I got paid $25 too for it. So I got to spend quite a bit of time in the first ring, which was terrible. And then they tossed me over into the second ring. And as soon as they tossed me over to the second ring, out I went. That was it. That was the end of my first match, and I was done.
I remember heading into my first match in Dallas, Texas, at the Sportatorium. I'd spent 5 months at the Chris Adams Wrestling Academy. Dude, it was only one day a week. I was in there with 25 other people. It was a two-hour class, so you know my training wasn't a whole lot of. Learned basic tumbling, learned how to take a bump, and then all of a sudden, Chris says, "Hey, man, I think you're ready for a match. You're gonna work with Frank Man LeBlanc." Just like the guy that broke you in, Chris didn't smarten us up. I'm sitting there, dude, I just finished playing 5 years. Well, been in college for 5 years, playing 4 years of college football. You know, I'm thinking, you know, there's got to be a fix here. I don't know how it works, but something's up. But I'll be damned, Chris Adams wasn't going to tell us what was up until I was going to have my first, you know, wrestling match with Frogman there at the Sportatorium. And all of a sudden, he told me how it worked. We kind of lined up a little bit of a match. And, hey, dude, I didn't know how to call a high spot.
Referee Tony Falk, who's wonderful and a damn good one.
Oh, yeah.
An awesome guy.
Yeah.
Tony Falk was trying. He was in there while we do this is live to tape. And the match was a Dreslin Chits. I sucked. You know, Frogman was okay. He wasn't the most athletic guy in the world. He was just okay. But me, I was as green as grass. It was horrible. But Chris didn't smarten me up either. And so that was the way they protected the business back then.
But back then, I mean, the training, and I try to explain that to the guys, like, you don't really learn at wrestling school. You learn the fundamentals and you learn the stuff that you need to learn. But what you really learn is now you go out in the ring and you're in front of an audience. And when you broke in, Steve, you never worked with anyone that was the same experience as you or even close. Everybody you worked with had been working 7 nights a week for 15, 20 years. And it'd just listen, kid, you'd be all right, you know? And they physically and verbally would tell you everything. And it was not like today where it's like, hey, I'm working with you, Steve. I was thinking maybe we could do this spot, and you know, I'd really like to do this thing, and I'd love to, you know, if you don't mind, when we would get this one move in. It was just, hey, you're working with so-and-so, and just listen. You would go out there. I'll never forget, I worked with Roger Kirby one night, and you know, he had held the world record for the leg press. That's back in the day when they would get up underneath it vertically. I think he pressed like 1,500 pounds or something, you know, and a Guinness World Record for it. And I remember trying to get up off the mat. I wouldn't sit still. And he just all of a sudden just squeezed on me, and I could just feel it. And he was like, hey, kid, don't move. And I would like try to fight, and all of a sudden he'd get a little tighter, and I said, don't move. And then a little tighter, my head felt like it was going to explode. My eyes were going to bust out. And I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I'll just not move. I'll just sit here right now. I'll just wait until he decides to get up. And that was how you learned, because he wasn't going to move you until the audience got to a certain spot that he wanted them at. Then he'd let you get up, you know, and he had the confidence to be able to take you out there and physically and mentally lead you.
Hi, I'm Daniel Rue, host of Real GM Radio, where every week I go in-depth on NBA basketball through conversations with some of the brightest basketball minds out there, including Kevin Pelton, Nate Duncan, Chris Herring, Tim Bontemps, and team experts from all around the league. We try to separate the truth from the noise for players, teams, and NBA draft prospects alike, with a focus on the basketball itself. If you want to know what is coming next in the NBA and why, there's no better place to turn than the weekly episodes of Real GM Radio. You can find us exclusively at podcastonesports.com or the new Podcast One app. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
And I'll never forget the nervous energy I would have. You know, when I first came into the Tennessee territory, I'd been working 2 months. They were just beating the shit out of me on Friday nights. Was the show every Friday for Dallas. Saturday morning was a TV taping. Pretty good looking kid, long blonde hair, and pretty decent physique. Of course, yeah. PY, Chew High, all the heels coming, just beating the just trash out of me, right? So I go over to Nashville. I'm living in Nashville. I'm traveling with Dutch Mantel and Chris Champion. I ain't making no money. I'm starving. I can't eat. Can't afford food. But just being in that locker room, and you know, the fairgrounds, Nashville fairgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
Heels over here, babies over here. Referee's going to come give you the finish because those dressing rooms do not connect. And it was kayfabe. And so all of a sudden you go out there, and I don't hear very well. Nonetheless, back then in those learning stages, all you knew was the finish, and you had to go out there and listen to the guy. It was like there was nervous energy, and you didn't want to screw anything up. And, you know, you're in front of a crowd. This is what you want to do, but you want to perform well. And, you know, you got to put on the best show you can. But you had pressure on you. You were nervous, and you had that energy. You're doing what you love to do and what you dreamed of doing. But you didn't have to think about anything because it was going to be called in the ring. It was so refreshing back then, because by the time I'd gotten out in 2003, I didn't want to get out. And to what the business has evolved into now, there's so much going on. But when you go down to the bare basics of it, to when you were a kid, or when I was watching as a kid, 7 or 8 years old, Houston wrestling, to when we started, just the business has changed so much. And I'm not condemning it, but I'm just saying that talking about kind of just trading starts. It was just, you're trying to elicit an emotional response from those people, or trying to get them to love you, hate you, dislike you, you know, whatever. And, you know, so it's psychology, but it's fun.
And the reason why is, and I think what's different today, and it's no fault of the younger talent, they're just not taught. They didn't get that experience like we talked about on the first show. They didn't, their experience coming in is different than what yours and I's was. And that, and, but that therein lies the problem. And that is that, they're trying to intellectualize something that should be done on an instinctual level. And that, they can make whatever excuse they want and any justification about, well, you can't grab a hold, and, you know, they don't have the attention span. They have whatever attention span you give them. If you grab a hold and you sell that hold and you work that hold correctly, they'll stay attentive because you are giving them something to watch. Doesn't mean you got to constantly be running and taking bumps. You got to just make them believe, in the context of trying to win and not lose, that that hold is going to play a part in it, and other than just you just sitting there to catch your breath. But you have to, because that, I always harp on this, but they do that 7-step formula match.
Tell me about that. Tell me about that. I've heard you talk about that in interviews, and here's one of the things. Chris Adams is no longer with us, but he wrote me out a match formula on a yellow legal pad. So I want to hear your 7-step formula match.
Okay. That match started out years ago, and the only time you or myself ever worked with, if we ever worked together, it was only on a spot show, and that was out in some middle podunk town that they were only going to come back to maybe once a year. So now they didn't worry about you hurting the business. They wanted to still protect it, and what they would do is they come up and they give you 4 steps. Now look, Al, you're the heel, so we need you to get Steve over. You understand? Make him look good. And then at the right time, think of some way to cut him off. Think of some way dirty. Like, do, but don't let that referee catch you. And when you cut him off, grind him. Beat the shit out of him. Get on him. Okay? Make those people want to see him kick your ass. When the time comes, you let him. Let him, however you get going, let him get going and let him come start working his way up off the mat and let him beat your ass. I mean, let him take it to you. Try to stop him. You'll go to backdrop him. He'll sunset flip you. 1, 2, 3. Let him slide out. He'll be on the floor. He'll celebrate. You're in the ring hotter than a flock of hens. You get it? Yeah, I got it. That was the 4 steps. There was no specific time frame or how that's been done, but it would be, okay, you guys got 8 minutes, which I knew as the heel meant, hey, if it's good, we'll go 10. If I get you over enough, we'll go home in 5. But I know we can't go 12 or 14 because now we're going to get some heat when we get back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because now we're going long and we're going into business for ourselves. So that was the 4-step formula. Now the formula is, and it's gotten so prevalent that I've seen it written on a chalkboard in Puerto Rico, in a dry erase board in Australia. I've seen it written up on a board in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And everybody takes the same approach. And I can go through why it don't work, but the step one is to shine the baby face. Let me tell you something. First off, that term, that's just some made up goddamn term. I don't care what you do. I care if you get the baby face over. Where he's going to shine is when he beats you. That's how he's going to shine. So get him over. Make the audience want to be the baby face. I don't care what you do. I don't care how long it takes in the match. If out of an 8-minute match, if it takes 7 minutes and 32 seconds for you to get that baby face over, where that audience really wants to be in, and you get one thing in, you just got one thing in, but at least you got a shit ton of heat when you got it. Step two is the heat spot. The heat spot is where the heel now, without cheating, without doing anything underhanded, without begging off, without pleading, does a bigger, more aggressive move than anything the babyface did in the shine. Now let me ask something. You're just the average guy, right? Who do you now want to be? Who's getting over?
No.
You want to be the babyface that just he did a bunch of stuff that amounted to nothing? You want to be the heel that in just one move knocked the shit out of the other guy?
You want to be the heel.
Well, now he's become the babyface. Let's move on to step three.
Exactly.
Step three is we get the heat. The heat is not a want or a need or desire. It's where the heel now gets his spots in that are always more bigger, more aggressive, and more kick-ass than anything that babyface did in the shine. And the heel, the baby face is laying there like a lump on the mat, dead. And again, that, you know, guys are going to get hot. They're going to be, no, I don't. Yeah, you do. You don't sell. In order for you to sell, I got to see your face. I can't see your face when you're looking straight up at the lights because the heel just hit you with some big ass move, which thus reinforces again, who do we want to be? We want to be the heel because he's kicking ass and taking names. Let's move on to step four. Step four is the hope spot. For me, it's I hope you go home, but you won't because you have three more steps. The hope spot's where the baby face mounts some kind of ineffectual offense that the heel, again, without cheating, without doing anything underhanded, without fagging off, without pleading, without overselling, just summarily cuts the baby face right back off again and grinds him even more. He does the old change gears. Doesn't mean he changes gears emotionally. He just punches and kicks you a lot faster and a lot harder. Nobody feels it. And I always ask the guys, hey, if you're going to punch me 10 times, which one do you want me to sell? First one or the second? Serious. I'll sell one of them, but I can only sell one. You decide which one. So now we go to step five. Step five is the double down. I don't know how this got started, but even when I would agent matches in TNA, it'd be a 3 or 4 minute match. It'd be like, oh, we're going to do a double down. I'm like, what happens in 3 minutes that caused both of you to go to the mat and lay there like you couldn't get up?
This is great. Yeah.
They got to do it. So the double down. Now, this is where it gets a little interesting. The heel, who has just had all the offense, has been stomping the living cow shit out of the babyface, either misses one move or is hit by one move and now sells as much as his babyface does, even though he's just had his ass kicked for 5 minutes, but the heel just took one move. So now who do we want to be? Neither one of you. Why? And that's a shoot. I'm just talking as an average guy watching wrestling. You know what I mean? Let's move on to the comeback. Now, the comeback apparently has come back from the dead. Because this entire time, the babyface has just been laying on the mat. He ain't been able to move. He ain't been able to mount any offense. He's not even been able to get a pulse. And listen, Jesus has nothing on wrestling babyfaces. It took 3 days for Jesus to nip up, and they had to put him in a hole and put a rock in front of it and wrap him in a shroud that's in Turin, Italy now. You, if you're a babyface in wrestling, you just nip up like nothing happened. You punch him 3 times. The heel now takes a bump on the third punch. You back him into the ropes. You shoot him off, you hit him with one big move, and now we go finish step seven, which is we move into the false finishes because none of them are false, because that would entail that we'd have to believe that that's the actual finish, and then you go home. That's the 7 steps of wrestling.
Jesus Christ, I'm crying over here.
Problem one, your match is just like every other match on the card. It's you just interchange tights and pads and kick pads and match one's the same as match 10. Emotionally, psychologically, your match is no different. It doesn't stand out. So you're in a business where you need to stand out to be an attraction, and you now wrestle just like everyone else. The other problem is babyface needs to get over. How do you know before you walk out there, before you've ever gotten in front of that audience, that with just these 3 high spots or that 2 or 3 minutes, that's going to be enough to get that babyface over, that when you cut him off, you've now made him everybody's car? That's going to get you actual heat. Heat's not you doing your offense, you getting to do your deal. Heat's now making that audience want to come in and either save the baby face or want to see the baby face kick your ass and beat you. And that's the comeback. A comeback is not, it's not a comeback to life. It's where at this point in time, when the baby face first came to the ring, his objective was beat you. But because of everything you did during the match, now in the comeback, it's where the baby face goes, first I want to beat your ass, then I want to beat you. And then he pays off all the heat you built. If you pulled his hair, he comes back, pulls yours. If you pulled his tights, he pulls yours. You punched him, he punches you. You know what I mean?
Yep.
He pays off everything you did that the audience wants to see him do back to you. He doesn't just do indiscriminate moves that look cool. He wants to fight. He wants to kick your ass. And that's why it doesn't work, because it's just, and it's killing the wrestling business. It's just absolutely killing it, because they're trying to intellectualize something that's done on an instinctual level. And I know this is a PG, it's a PG show, but I have to say it. The whole purpose for you to the art form of physical storytelling of wrestling is to take an audience and through every action you do, body language, facial expressions, which Those are real high spots. High spots, not a tackle drop down hip toss. That's something Buddy Rogers created, which was called chain wrestling, which they think is where you do switches and reversals, and that has nothing to do with it. But we won't even get into that. But you do all of this to emotionally make an audience care and become invested and take them for a ride so that they pop. They emotionally have an orgasm at the end. Wrestling's no different than having sex. I mean, it quite honestly is exactly the same. Watch porno tapes and then go, you know what, I'm going to try that high spot the next time I'm having sex with my girl. You don't think it, you do it, you feel it, you, and that's where I think the big thing shift has come, is that intrinsically wrestling, you can call whatever you want backstage, call as much as you want backstage. And I have a great story about that if you want, where I use that to.
What's the story?
And this will illustrate why, you know, everybody gets all, you know, they think, well, we had a great match. All the spots came off. We did everything we called. I don't care if you did everything called. Did the crowd react? Did you get them? And I tell guys all the time, I'm the easiest guy to work with, because you can call whatever you want backstage. I don't care. Call whatever you want. And if we do it, we do it. If we don't. I don't care. Nobody knows but us, you know? So to illustrate this, I always tell the story about the Shane twins, the Gemini twins. You remember them?
Yeah, I sure do.
I mean, great guys. Awesome, you know, built. I mean, they were both just, you know, all swole up, right? Look, good looking guys. I think the one brother had, you know, they'd both been working for like 10 years at that time, wrestling for 10 years. They get sent to OVW. And they have a dark match with Kenny Dykstra, who was Kenny from the Spirit Squad,
yep.
Who's immensely talented. And then with Dolph Ziggler, he was Nick Nemeth at the time, who's also immensely talented guy, right? So you should, this should be a no-brainer. You should have a good tag match with these guys. I mean, so I'll never forget, Jimmy is sitting out there, because he at the time was doing commentary, and it's a dark match. So you hear Jimmy, the mic's open, but it's only open to the back. You just hear him going, oh, goddamn, what the hell is this? Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, that's the shit, you know? And he's, oh, my God. And he's just getting hotter and hotter, because the match is, it's terrible. Now we get to the finish. And because the people that don't know, and you can back me up on this, the Shane twins look like they were cloned out of a Petri dish. Do they not lie?
Yeah.
Am I not lying? I mean, yeah. They look, you can stand them right beside each other, right in front of you. You could not tell one from the other, could you?
Right.
That's important. That's a part of the story. You cannot, it'd be like looking at you with your brother sitting right beside you, and he looks just like you. I mean, to a T. It's like they, honest to God, like they grew them somewhere. So we get to the finish. Big four-way. Shane Twin number one goes to the floor with Nick Nemeth, and I watch him post Nick Nemeth. Shane Twin number two is attempting to do the old baby, you know, the old spot where he grabs the baby face around the waist. Doesn't grab him around the waist. Puts him in the old full Nelson. And this comes into play here in a second. Shane Twin number one now gets back in the ring, and I know something's amiss because I'm watching the monitor, and I see the Shane Twin number one lift up his forearm, look over at Kenny Dykstra and his brother, look back at his forearm and kind of go and shrug his shoulders. Like, oh, I'm like, what was that? And it happened pretty quick, you know.
Yeah.
Here he comes charging. He's going to, now we're going to do the spot where he goes to hit the baby face, but the baby face ducks and he hits his brother. Problem is, his brother's put him in a full Nelson. He's not put him around the waist. So now when Kenny ducks, what's it do? Drags Shane Twin number two straight down. So now Shane Twin number one's forearm just grazes the bald head of Shane Twin number two, who immediately, Steve, I'm not exaggerating, stands up like a 220-volt cable was shoved up his ass, looks to the left, looks to the right, and then like somebody from a grassy knoll shot him right in the head, and he just falls dead on the mat. So dead that Kenny and Shane Twin number one have to kick him out of the way so that now Nick can feed in and they can do the finish. Cornette goes ballistic, just goes insane, right? Takes him in the back, takes him in a room. I don't know why he took him in a room, because everybody in the building could hear. I mean, everybody could hear him. And now, I swear to God, it sounded like, you know, the GPS on your phone?
Yeah.
It sounded like that thing exploded. And I don't know, to this day, I don't know how he did it, but he, honest to God, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you, he gave them turn by turn directions to McDonough, Georgia. You go out of this motherfucking parking lot on Old Shepherdsville Road, you take a right, you go a quarter of a mile down, and he named every street and every turn to I-75, down I-75, the exact exit numbers they would have to take, and then every turn and street that they would have to take to get to the front door of the Deep South wrestling territory, tell them Jody Hamilton sent him, right? He was so mad, right? So, show goes on. He fired them from a developmental territory he couldn't fire them from. It was amazing. So, we get done. A couple days later, we're going to watch the show back. We watch the match back. I'm like, guys, what is going on? Why was this match so bad? And they're, the one's giving me a bunch of excuses. I go, okay, what happened on the finish? Just explain to me what happened on the finish. Here's what was told to me. And that this is a shoot, too. Swear to God. The wrong twin grabbed the baby face. Sorry, what? Yeah, the wrong guy grabbed the baby face. You look exactly alike. What does it matter who grabs who? Not to mention, I could have painted one of you red and the other one blue. Nobody would have known because you'd have called it in the back. Who cares? But they were so set on what they had called, the way they had called it to happen, the way they had said it, that they completely exposed the business to the point to where the fans scoff-booed the finish.
Right.
They were like, oh, come on, we'll buy a lot, but we ain't buying that. And that's what happens when guys go out there and they call all of the stuff in the back. I watch them. They call it all. They leave. And you see them rehearsing it, visualizing it in their heads. They get back together. They call it again. They kind of in and make a few changes. They leave. They go rehearse it in their heads. And then what happens is, one, when they're doing spot A, they're never emotionally there. They're always trying to remember the next spot, spot B. Two, they're doing it at the pace that they rehearsed it in their heads. So they know what's happening, but the audience doesn't because they can't keep up. Not to mention, the biggest thing that happens is, and I always use you, I use Bubba from his time in TNA, Undertaker, a lot of guys as examples, and that is, you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck backstage. You're a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you walked to the ring. You're a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you would cut a promo. And when the bell rang, you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you were kicking ass. And you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you were getting your ass kicked. And you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you won. And you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck when you lost. And you were a beer-drinking, ass-kicking redneck on the way back. At no point in time was there a break in that chain. You were always the guy that you sold to them. But when you get in your head that you have to do every one of these spots, you might do a character or a gimmick backstage that really gets over. We get it. We see who you are. We dig it. We understand it. We buy into it. But now when the bell rings, you get so caught up in what has to happen, the way you have to call it, that you stop being that guy. Now you just become another guy in a pair of trunks bumping around in the ring that we don't connect with, we don't identify with, because we don't see the same guy that you sold us prior to the match, in the match, Ric Flair was always Ric Flair, That's why it worked. Ricky Steamboat was always Ricky Steamboat. Randy Savage was always Randy Savage. There was, Jake Roberts was always Jake Roberts. There was never a point in even the match that they just became this guy that was in a pair of tights. They were always the guy. I tell guys all the time, don't buy the bullshit like, old timers would call spots too. But they always called everything they called with the understanding, hey, if they do it, we do it.
Right.
You don't do it. Nobody cares. It was never set in stone. And when you do this, you intellectualize something that should be done on an instinctual level, and you then you never truly are emotionally in the match. So therefore, your audience is never truly emotionally in the match. And as a result, you never get them to truly have an orgasm. Now they're not as motivated to watch. They're not motivated to pay to see you, And ultimately, regardless of what anybody says, I know we all say, wrestling's changed. All right, because back in 1982, if I was put on TV, if I was in a spot, but I wasn't back then, but let's just say I was. 1982, I was put on TV. My job was on that TV show was, if you're watching, flipping through the channels, even in 1982, they flipped through the channels. It was 12 or 13 at that time, but not 150.
Right.
But you were flipping through the channels. My job was to keep you from turning that channel to the next station. And then if I could keep you, if we went to commercial break during whatever I was doing, was to make sure that I did whatever I needed to do to keep you from turning the channel during the commercial break. Now I got to do whatever I have to do to make sure that next week you tune back in and watch me again. And then when we come to town, I got to convince you, based on whatever you watch me doing on TV, who I am, why I did it, that you're going to leave the safety and comfort of your house, which safety is a big thing now, get in a car, drive to a building, pay to park, and then pay a bunch of money to get in, to sit in a seat that nobody wants to sit. Let's face it, we don't like those seats. Nobody does. And you're going to pay to sit in that seat around people you don't want to sit around, because we've all seen, to pay for food you don't want to eat, to watch me do my job. Because that ultimately is why I'm in that ring. It's to motivate you to leave your house. That's why movie stars are held in higher regard than television stars. Because a television star doesn't take any investment to watch him do his job. I mean, they're great actors. I'm not going to take it away from them. But a Tom Cruise is held in a higher esteem because he's got to motivate people to leave their house to go watch him in a movie theater. Now let's face it, how hard it's damn near impossible to get people to leave their house to go sit in a leather recliner in a dark room to watch a multi-billion dollar motion picture. Now you're asking us to go watch two guys homoerotically fake fight each other in their underwear buttered up like a tub of popcorn and pay to do it.
Hey, what were your thoughts back in the day when the guys are wearing that, hot stuff that all the body guys are putting on?
I hated that stuff. Hated that.
Were you one of those guys?
No. And I've never been a body guy, so I never had to put that stuff on. So. I just worked with a guy not that long ago. He had put hot stuff on, and damn if he did not grab me in a headlock, and my eye went right on his chest, and it all got up in my eye, and I couldn't see, and I'm like, oh, man, why do you wear that stuff? Jesus Christ, man. The last thing you need to do is put that hot stuff on.
Hey, before we started part two of this podcast, we were talking about some of the stories from the indie scene. Do you remember those stories you want to tell?
Which one you want to hear about the me and the six midgets? You want to hear about the night the horses?
Give me a good indie story.
So I go down south, right? Of course, they always fly you in early, you know, and it's too early to get in the hotel. So, of course, what do? They take me right to the building, and it's like 2 p.m, you know, and I'm like, why am I here? And I'm like, well, you know, we can't get you into the hotel until check in till like 3 or 4. And I'm like, I left at like 5 a.m, you know, since September 11th, you know, you either catch the early morning flight or you're done. So I'm sitting there, and it's a nice National Guard armor. And the promoter, and it is nice. He comes up, he's got his cowboy hat on. He's got the Black Bart goatee.
Yeah.
Got the mullet in the back. And I'm nothing against the mullets. I mean, you know, especially it's the only full action hairstyle. When you could throw a punch, it swings with you. You know, when you get hit, it flies. We all had mullets. We all did. I had it too. So I'm not knocking the mullet. He's about 5'8". You can see he's got the drum. And he comes sauntering up. He's got a bit of chaw in his mouth. And he goes, "Hey, kid, we got ourselves a problem here. Can I talk to you for a second?" I'm like, "Here we go. You know, this guy's now going to tell me he can't pay me or something. I'm going to have to break his thumb." That's another story. He's like, "Can we come over here and talk?" And I'm like, "Okay, sure. Yeah, what's the deal, man?" And he's like, "Well, you know, I don't want to offend, you know, you being a former AA superstar and all, you know, but this here show is kind of like our WrestleMania." I'm like, "Oh, okay. What's the problem?" He goes, "Well, I don't know if you noticed, but me and my son, we was the tag team champions." I'm like, "Oh, really? Well, that's a surprise. I mean, you own the company, so, you know, I'm really kind of shocked." He goes, "Well, we got this cowboy gimmick. Hadn't picked up on that." Meanwhile, he's standing there, cowboy hat, you know, and he's got his cowboy boots on. And I'm like, "What's the problem?" He's still anticipating he ain't going to pay me. Right, and I'm getting ready to. We're gonna have a serious conversation. Like, "Well, I don't want to offend you. You know, you being a former AA superstar, you're not gonna offend me. This is our WrestleMania. Yeah, we've covered that. What do you need? Well, it being our WrestleMania, we're expecting a big house. Well, that's good. And what's the issue? We was thinking maybe, you know, you might want to go on early." Because me and the boy, we got us a hell of an entrance, and I don't think you're going to be able to top it. I go, "That's the problem?" He's like, I don't want to offend, you know, you being a former WWE superstar. I go, listen, brother, you can't offend me. You want me to go on? I could not be happier. When do you need, what's the entrance? Here we go. When he says the entrance, I, of course, kind of look over at the ring. Now, they've already set up the chairs, tons of chairs. They've got the entrance with, they've got the rail leading down to the ring, and it's, there's maybe a 2-foot span around the ring where this rail is. And, so what's the entrance? He goes, well, you know, me and the boy, we got us a cowboy. Yeah, I know. I got it. He goes, well, we just going to be riding some horses to the ring. I'm like, what? Excuse me? I honestly, I can't make this shit up, Steve. Yeah, we're going to ride some horses. I'm like, get out of here. He goes, nope, it being our WrestleMania, we thought we needed to make a hell of an entrance. I said, well, that, let me tell you, that's going to be a hell of an entrance. I'm already popping because I'm thinking, what do you, you know, I'm like, how are you going to get the horses down? He goes, well, I'm going to ride out first. I'm going to go to the right. My son's going to ride out second. He's going to go to the left. Now I'm looking at the ring and I'm thinking, they're going to be head on. How are you going to get these two animals from around that ring before the match starts?
Ain't a whole lot of room in a National Guard.
No. So I'm like, brother, I'll go on anytime you want. I have no problem with it. Because immediately I flashed back to Mid-South Coliseum with Bill Dundee riding the motorcycle. And then the spotlight hits in his eyes, and he revs the thing and pops a wheelie and takes out like 5 or 6 rows. And in Australia, I'm sitting there on an independent show, and this guy's on his friend's motorcycle. He's going to make a big entrance, right? And I'm like, you ever rode that? He goes, I don't need to ride it. I'm just going to push it out. And he's, ram, ram, ram. So he goes out, and he makes the entrance, right? Ram, ram. He makes a turn, and he's, ram, ram. Crowd's yelling. And this guy hands him a beer. He starts drinking the beer. Where's his left hand? It's on the clutch. He didn't put it in neutral. So this kid reaches over the rail and starts ram, 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 and just and the guy still got the beer, sees it. He's got the beer in this hand, reaches with his left. So off goes the clutch, bike, and takes out 3 or 4 rows. Awesome, right? So I'm like, when I hear the horses, I'm like, man, this is going to be fantastic. I cannot wait. What do you need me to do? I thought, he goes, well, we don't want to put you on too early. I go, put me on right after intermission. That's fine with me. I don't mind. So I don't leave the building now. I stay all day because I want to see these horses. So I'm like a kid on Christmas. I'm like, I cannot wait for these things. So the show starts, horses still aren't there, and I'm not trying to smarten the guy up, but I'm like, hey, where? The horse is coming. He goes, yeah, they're going to be here. They'll be here. They're running a little late. They'll be here. I'm like, all right, I just, you know, this being your WrestleMania, I don't want to see it, you know, blow your spot, man. I'd be okay. You're a hell of a guy. You're nice. You really concerned about it. Yeah, I want to see you get over. Shit, I'm willing to go on. Anytime you need me to go on, I want to see you get over. So we get to intermission. I'm out there whoring myself out, sell my merch, and I see, you know, through the open door, I look, here comes the horse trailer. I'm like, well, boys, yes, we got to pack it up. So I immediately run out the back. Well, I tell you, like, these were the biggest animals I've ever seen come off that trailer. Like, these horses were enormous. And I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be amazing because they're going to go down there. How are they going to get them out? They're giant horses. So I'm on right after admission. I could not have hit that guy with a plastic head faster and just get the match done. And, you know, me, I'm professional. I care about, but I didn't. All I wanted to do is just beat him, get the pop, get out. Get to the back, set the chair down right by the curtain. Don't move. There's 2 more matches. And every time when somebody would come up, I'd be like, hey, don't go long, guys. You understand? Don't go on. I want you just need to get in, get your business done, get out. Okay? Just go get in there. So I could not wait to get those guys out of there because I didn't care about them. I only cared about the entrance of the tag team champions. So here we go. Main event time, right? There was an upstairs locker room. I'm sitting by the chair. I'm sitting by the curtain on my chair. I haven't moved. I'm still sweating. Just got a towel around me. Here comes Dad out first. Got the black cowboy hat on, got the long black duster on, okay, got some chaw in his mouth. Got a tag team belt that's bigger than a stop sign. It runs from like the solar plexus all the way down to his penis, okay? Son's right behind him. Saint looks just exactly like him. Got the mullet, got the black Black Bart goatee, okay? He's got the cowboy hat on, got the black duster, but he's about 2 inches taller. He's about 5'10". They both got the derby. They got the drum going. Okay. They got the old butcher top. Remember the old butcher top? It comes down like this. So it helps lift and separate those man boobs so they stick out even more. Okay. They got the black trunks over the black tights, the old school.
Yeah.
With the white horseshoes airbrushed on the side, down to the wrestling cowboy boots.
Yeah.
They're all black. Hot, light trim, white highlights on it so you see the scroll work. Okay. They come out, they come around, they get up on the horses. And when Dad gets up on the horse, I'm like, I watch rear end, like, kind of like, get a little jiggity, you know, and I'm like, man, what a fat bastard, you know, that broke the horse down. And I'm, you know, from Texas, you broke horses, right?
Yep.
What do you have to do when you take them off the dirt and you take them out somewhere, off like on a road or something? You have to take the metal shoes off, don't you?
We never use horseshoes down there in South Texas, but okay. So they're wearing horseshoes.
They're
slicker now shit.
You've been in National Guard armories.
Yep.
What are the floors like in National Guard armories?
Oh, hard concrete or ceramic tile, slippery.
And highly polished.
Highly polished.
Let's continue with my story. So I'm sitting there, and I'm the only one that really kind of notices the horse kind of get a little jiggy. I'm like, so now the strains of Bon Jovi's Wanted Dead or Alive begin to play.
Of course.
The dad saunters up on the horse where I'm at. He pulls his shoulders back. His man boobs stick further out. He looks down at me. I swear to you, looks down at me, pushes up his head, and he goes, watch this. I'm like, I'm not taking my eyes off of you. Don't worry. I'm not moving anywhere, buddy. Hits a certain note. He goes through the curtain. He gets about three or four steps, and all four hooves kind of go like this. Like, and I'm the only one watching. Like, the owners are talking to some of the wrestlers, and everybody's having a good time. And I look back, and I was like, what was that? Right? Horse goes about three or four more steps, and again. Now, the horse freezes up. It knows something's not right.
Yep.
And the dad's like, and you can see him kind of, come on, kicking him in the sides, and the horse don't want to move. And I'm like, guys, something's not working here. And he finally, and the horse kind of up a little bit, takes about two steps, and then takes a bump. Feet slipped right out from underneath it, and it just, bam, hits the floor. Dad rolls off. The horse goes to try to stand up, falls again, then panics. The minute it panics, it starts shitting and pissing everywhere. Like it's coming out like a fire hose. Like, Steve, I can't imagine how an animal could have that much excrement in a bowel. It never stopped. It just, the more it tried to stand up, the more it would slip, the more it would slip, the more it would piss and it would shit. It would just, and now it's kicking and the fans, shit's splattering people everywhere, and fans are screaming as if it's a circus tent on fire, and they're he's literally watching people throw people in front of them and shit splattering them. And he's trying to get the horse under control. The owners come running out. They grab the horse. They get him back on his feet. They get it out of there, and the building's cleared out. It's done. He comes wandering back. He's just covered from head to toe in just horse shit and horse piss. He walks through the curtain. I just, I looked at him. I went, you're right. I couldn't top that. And then I just walked on. I got dressed. It was the most awesome thing I'd ever seen. The horse was fine. He didn't get hurt. But my God, I mean, what are you thinking? You know what I mean? It's just no rehearsals, no, you know, that because wrestling, you know that. We just do stuff. You know what I mean?
Never think about just some shitty cheap indoor-outdoor carpet just to roll down that aisle just instead of that polished floor.
We're just going to ride the horse out. That'll be good.
So did the son never make it out, and he didn't go down in a ball of flames?
He was cussing, and he was mad because his dad was so stupid and couldn't even ride a goddamn horse to the ring, he said. And he was out there just calling him every name in the book because he had killed his big entrance. And they had a sold-out house, too, until that happened. I mean, it scattered out quicker.
So the main event never made it to the ring?
No, it didn't make it to the ring. Horse took a bump. You couldn't get any more higher than that.
You know, and here's the thing. You go out with a gimmick like that, it backfires on you. The horse shits and pisses everywhere. In theory, you could still walk out and have your match.
You could if you were heels, but they were the baby faces. So, you know, I'd have turned heel and just took it, you know, and went right from there. But they couldn't do it.
You ain't got to get no heat on them. Just fucking go home.
Well, the audience had already taken off because they'd been covered in just everything.
Hey, before we ride off into the sunset, tell people about tell people about Collar and Elbow Clothing and your school and your social media.
CollarandElbowBrand.com. You can go to CollarandElbowBrand.com and you can get. We're trying to create a brand for wrestling. We're trying to create different designs that are for wrestling fans. The reason I did it was because no matter what, even after 36 years, I'm still a fan of wrestling. I cannot say how blessed and how grateful I am that I've gotten to do what I love to do for as long as I've gotten to do it. And the only reason I continue to do it is because I love it so much. And that Collar and Elbow is just some way of expressing that and trying to share that with other people. So go to collarandelbowbrand.com. And then I'm on social media as The Real Al Snow. They were fakes, I know. And then Al Snow Wrestling Academy. We've got 4 in the UK, London, Cheshire, and then the Midlands, and I can't remember the 4th one. It's in southern England. One in Romania, Denmark, Chile, Portugal, Greece, and working on one in Italy and one in Germany as well. And maybe eventually, for a much easier commute, I'll actually put one here in the United States. Maybe in Alaska, you know, I'll get a Al Snow Wrestling Academy in Alaska. So, you know, there's no point in making it easy where I can just have one right here in Louisville so I can just get in the car and drive. I've got to take an 8-hour flight. So,
hey, man, it was good talking to you, Al, and glad to see you. Glad to see you doing so well and so busy with everything you're doing. Hey, in a couple of weeks, come back, and I'll put together a specific conversation to ask you a bunch of bullshit questions.
Sure, yeah.
It was good for the past 2 episodes, just shooting the breeze and catching up and hearing stories.
Yeah, if I haven't angered enough young wrestlers, we can come back and I can do some more. What do you know? You're right, I don't know anything. I've made all of your mistakes.
Hey, when I was talking about Lima, Ohio, was I pronouncing that wrong?
It's Lima. Lima,
I know, I'm glad I did that because I always do that with Illinois. People say it's Illinois. No, it's Illinois. So I always like to mispronounce every town or state.
So that they remember it. Yeah. And that's funny you mentioned that because it was a gimmick. I remember Mickey Doyle?
Yeah.
What's his name? Was Bulldog Brown. Would come out and would purposely screw up Mickey Doyle's name because Mickey was a heel. So he'd purposely on promos and all that, he'd always call him some other name. He'd always purposely screw it up to where Mickey would get hot. And then they literally built an angle out of this where, you know, and back in the day when, what was his name? Mark Jindrak and Lance, I can't remember his name. Cade. Was it Lance Cade? Cade? They're great guys, you know, good guys. But they were young and they didn't understand. When I was doing commentary on Sunday Night Heat, I would purposely mess up their names because they were heels.
Yeah.
And I would purposely, because I was, again, I should have communicated it, you know what I mean? But I just assumed that everybody kind of got the idea that this was a work and that everybody would understand what you're doing, which was, if I keep screwing up their names, number one, people will remember them because they'll go, no, their name's Mark Jindrak, it's Lance Cade. Where if I would screw it up, it would stand out more. So I was trying to get them over, and I was trying to get them to where we could do an angle where they would then jump me and beat the piss out of me so I'd get heat on them for me screwing up their name.
Right.
You know, and try and help them. But they went and complained about it, and then I was pulled aside and told, don't mess up their names anymore. You're hurting their feelings. And I'm like, but that's not what I'm doing. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it to hurt anybody's feelings. I'm doing it to try and actually get them over and to try and give them a reason to get to me. So.
Jesus Christ.
I probably should have been a better communicator with people back in the day instead of just doing stuff on my own.
God damn it. Hey, Al, it's good catching up with you. We will do it again, sir.
Yes, sir. I would love to.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you, Steve.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers podcast with Jay Moore, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, The Harbaugh's podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sessions with Randy Jackson, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or PodcastOne.com.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my guest, the snowman, Al Snow, being on the podcast once again. It was good talking to you. Check out his line of merch at collarandelbowbrand.com. And for some of my shit, go check out prowrestlingtees.com/Steve Austin to get all the damn shirts I wore on the Broken Skull Challenge. And if you were thirsty and you want to try an IPA or you love IPAs, I got one for your ass. Broken Skull IPA at El Segundo Brewing Company. If you live in California, check it out at Whole Foods and Total Wines. If you don't live in Cali, check insidetheseller.com and see if they ship to your state. And folks, everybody needs a pocket knife. I repeat, everybody needs a pocket knife. Check out my Cold Steel Broken Skull knife or the new Cold Steel Working Man's knife, and you can get them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. Hey, I want to say one more time, thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. You can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. And speaking of Podcast One, the new Podcast One app is now available for download at the App Store or Google Play. There ain't another podcast app like this one anywhere, and that's because the new Podcast One app is loaded with some cool features that let you do a lot more than just listen to your favorite shows. You can access behind-the-scenes photos, articles, and connect with other fans of the shows you like. Watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos, and you can actually watch some of your favorite shows in virtual reality. It's like you're sitting in the same room with them. So get to the App Store or Google Play and download the new Podcast One app now. Folks, send your questions in for Brutus the Barber Beefcake to questions@steveaustinshow.com. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.